This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Right, hello New Zealand and welcome to another episode of Turn the Page. My name is Mark Pacey from the Wairarapa Archive and today I'm taking you through three more stories from our past. Straight into it, the Castle Point Lighthouse was first lit by keepers in January of 1913 and was originally fuelled by oil. It wasn't until 1954 that the light became electric, powered by a diesel generator on site. The job was not without its risks. In 1922, after lighting the tower, Chief Keeper Alexander Duncan placed a ladder against a telephone pole near the lighthouse to repair a telephone line that had broken. Later, two men, Edward Barton and William Ansell, were walking in the area when they saw what looked like an overcoat lying on the ground. It was Duncan. He had fallen while repairing the line. Nothing could be done for him, and he was already dead. For another four decades, the keepers kept the light diligently lit and did their job, ensuring that the beacon was lit every evening to keep the seafarers safe. But by the 1980s, things had begun to change. Lighthouse keepers were becoming redundant due to the advancements in technology. Instead of relying on a keeper or keepers to walk to the tower at the correct time and turn on the light, this job could now be automated, and it could be controlled from many miles away. All over the country, lighthouse keepers were being told they were no longer needed, and one by one they were let go. Castle Point would not be spared. In May of 1988, the government decided that the remaining 12 lighthouses that were still manned, which included Castle Point, were to be automated. Palliser Lighthouse had been automated 2 years prior. The last day for Castle Point's beacon to be lit by keeper Grant Hinchcliffe's end was set for August 31st of that year. The automation went ahead, but due to a change in plan, Hinchcliffe remained as Minister for Transport. Bill Jeffries had delayed letting go Hinchcliffe. Castle Point and two other lighthouses, Bering Head and Nugget Point, also had their keepers stay put for a further 3 months to allow time for the keepers to relocate. Hinchcliffe could now remain under full pay at Castle Point until the end of November. It was a difficult time for Hinchcliffe. He had been keeper at Castle Point for 20 years. To no longer have that position would be a huge change. The Public Service Association made a submission to keep the keepers, and there was optimism that Hinchcliffe would be allowed to stay on. A paper was submitted to Jeffries outlining the reasons. After some consideration, Jeffries made his decision. The ministry would go ahead with their original decision. Castle Point would be fully automated, and Hinchcliffe was out of a job. New Zealand has a coastline of 5,680 kilometres. Nobody would seriously suggest that seven lighthouse keepers could fully monitor that length of coastline, Jeffries said in a statement. He also outlined the large savings that would be made due to the automations and redundancies of the human keepers. On November 30th, Castle Point Lighthouse lost its human heart. Hinchcliffe had visited the tower twice a day for 18 years, in which he did five weather reports a day, seismic reports, and took tours up the tower. The days were demanding, each starting at 5:30 a.m. By his last day, he had walked the incline to the lighthouse 13,000 times, and now made the journey one last time. Castle Point Lighthouse was now fully automatic. Hinchcliffe decided to take early retirement once he was let go and relocated to Sydney, saying goodbye to his home and his job of two decades. Despite being over 2,000 kilometres away, the keeper still held a candle for his old tower, which would always be a part of him. I still think of it as my lighthouse. Right, and in keeping with lighting and lights and everything, I thought, well, what piece of music can we play? And then, of course, it was very, very obvious I had to play this one.
It would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through. Time to wallow in the mire. funeral pyre. Time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the light on.
The Doors, Light My Fire. And for the musos out there, it's hard to believe, but they didn't have a bass player. Ray Manzarek would play it on his keyboard, play the bass line as well as the keyboard line. Immensely talented. That's also the slightly shorter version. It's about a 7 or 8 minute song with extended parts in the middle, but I thought I'd play the shorter one. Right, second story. The world was warming to Japan in the early 1960s. Tokyo had been chosen as the host for the 1964 Olympic Games, and Westerners were starting to travel to Japan in greater numbers. Japanese people were also traveling and visiting countries all over the world. In early 1963, Hisako Arai, whose title was Chief Television Demonstrator for Japan for the New Zealand Meat Producers Board, and her assistant, Masako Ueda, were in New Zealand. They were demonstrating ways of cooking mutton to members of the Japan Society and to representatives of the Meat Board in Wellington, who sponsored their visit. The cooking classes were popular, and they were asked to travel around the country to show alternative ways to enjoy mutton with a Japanese twist. Masterton was to be one of the stops, and on July 16, the two women arrived. As the evening closed in, 200 people that the newspaper described as members of various whited upper women's organizations and their husbands filled into the Masterton Town Hall. Mayor Tankersley welcomed the two Japanese women to Masterton and settled in to watch the show. Mrs. Arai, who spoke no English, explained first some of the methods of preparing and cooking mutton, her assistant, Miss Ueda, translating. Mutton was sliced very thinly, she explained, and cooked in various ways. Because the meat was so narrow, it cooked much faster than the traditional New Zealand roasts New Zealanders were used to. It was explained that in Japan, they mainly cooked using plates to prepare their meals and didn't have the ovens that were the staple of the Kiwi kitchen. The rest of the ingredients were described. Some the audience knew, others were entirely new. Peanuts, onions and peppers were familiar to those in attendance, but the likes of ginger juice and rice wine was something a bit different. The meat and the vegetables were all cooked together and served with rice. Alternatives for some of the more exotic ingredients suggested including using regular wine in place of rice wine. Over the course of the night, several dishes were demonstrated, which included chabo chabo, a name derived from the sound mutton makes when it is placed into boiling water, and the very Japanese sounding fried mutton with peanuts. Those in attendance also got to hear what it was like living in Japan, less than 2 decades after the end of the war. The cities were becoming very westernized, Arai explained, and meat was something of a luxury item. Rice was the main component of most residents' diets. New Zealand mutton was now being shipped to Japan and becoming very popular, especially with younger people, as it was priced quite reasonably. Older people, R.I. said, tended not to eat meat. The wider upper winter was also not a big issue to the two women, who were used to the cold Japanese weather. At home in Japan, the winter is even colder than this. Snow falls in the city streets, and in comparison, it is much colder than we have felt here so far, Arai explained. The Japanese women were quite taken by Wairarapa and the rest of New Zealand. Arai was especially taken by the kind of hospitality shown to her during her time spent here, and remember her visit fondly, describing New Zealand as a very friendly country. And for those who are interested, here is Hisako Arai's fried mutton with peanuts recipe. Ingredients: 3/4 of a pound of mutton, sliced, 1 tablespoon of ginger juice, 1 tablespoon of rice wine, 2 tablespoons of soy sauce, 6 tablespoons of corn flour, 1 egg yolk, 10 ounces of chopped peanuts, and frying oil. You cut the mutton into thin slices and marinate in the ginger juice, rice wine, and soy sauce for 10 minutes. Dust the meat with corn flour, dip in the egg yolk, and sprinkle with chopped peanuts and fry. And yes, I have tried that, and it was actually quite tasty. The only thing I found difficult was having the peanuts remain stuck to the meat rather than to your wok or your frying pan. But it was very, very good. Okay, in keeping with the Japanese thing, I'm now going to play a piece of music from one of my favourite bands, who are Japanese, who are called X-Japan. This is Kurenai. That was Kurenai from X-Japan. Are they my favourite band? Possibly. They're definitely a contender. We're on to our last story already. Robert Douglas was sentenced to life in prison for assault in Aupaki in 1898 and was sent to Littleton Jail to serve his sentence. Douglas had been living in the Aupaki area and was a suspect in another death, but nothing was ever proven to link him to that case. In the same year as Robert's crime got him imprisoned, Susanna Payne was found dead in mysterious circumstances. No one was ever tied to her death, and it was put down to an accident. Then, 3 years later, Douglas made a confession. Speaking to the warden, he said he was the one responsible for the death of Mrs. Payne. This was relayed to the higher authorities, and Sergeant O'Malley made his way to Wellington to arrange a trial. A date was set for August 12, 1901, which allowed time for witnesses to be brought to Wellington to attend. Douglas had previously stated that he was the last one to see Payne alive. She had gone out rabbiting with her two dogs, which she did regularly, but the dogs had returned without her. A search was made in which Douglas was a member, and Mrs. Payne's body was discovered down a creek. Her slipper was found further up the bank. It was originally thought that Payne had had a fit and had fallen down the bank, striking her head on a rock and losing her slipper in the process. She had been prone to having fits, and after which she needed a rest. Her death was believed to have been just a horrible accident, but with Douglas's confession, that changed. The day of the trial came around, and Douglas was called forward to make his plea. For someone that had made such a convincing confession of his crimes while in prison, his reply came as a bit of a shock. Not guilty. The details of the case were brought up again, and several members of the search party and Payne's husband were called up to make their statements. The location of the body, the slipper, the wounds were all still possible to have been caused by Payne having a fit and falling down the hill, at the bottom of which there was a pond surrounded by rocks. Douglas's confession just wasn't stacking up. The court then looked upon Douglas's character and called in the wardens from Littleton Jail to tell the court what kind of person he was. He was mentally weak. He was very irritable. On one occasion, it took two or three wardens to put the prisoner into his cell. Douglas's lawyer then made closing statements that put the case into perspective, describing the prisoner's confession as a hysterical accusation of one who might hope was dead, who had desired any change, even though it might be only from the jail to the lunatic asylum. He then said the details of the case still pointed to an accidental death, and that Douglas, although guilty of one crime, was not involved in the death of Mrs. Payne. The jury deliberated for less than 2 hours before they came back with their decision, not guilty. Douglas was returned to prison, although there were concerns over his mental state. He was now in the Terrace Prison in Wellington, and by 1906, it was stated that he is in fairly good health, but becomes very despondent at times, being under the impression that his relatives appear to have forgotten him. Despite these concerns, he continued to serve his sentence for his original crime. Okay, and trying to find prison-y type music from soundtracks, had to come to this one. I had a lot to choose from. So this is the bit from right at the end, which is sort of a bit of a montage of all the other themes. These are the end titles from the very brilliant movie, The Shawshank Redemption. Thank you. because the end titles to The Shawshank Redemption is a difficult watch, but it's a very good movie. I'm sure that's Thomas Newman as well. He does some other very, very good soundtracks. That's pretty much us for the day as well. Hopefully you've managed to adjust to daylight saving. I certainly had problems with it. It took me forever to fall asleep last night, and then getting up this morning when my alarm went off was certainly a struggle. But I made it here. I've got a nice energy drink waiting for me back at work, so I'll be fine. And, of course, I cannot leave you without a joke. I went through various ones. We can't really joke about murder. What else can we not probably joke about? Lighthouses. I think we did a lighthouse one with the shipwreck one. It's probably the best joke I've ever actually said on the radio. So if we've brought it back to one about cooking and bringing the bar way down. My wife hates it when I keep borrowing her utensils, but it's a whisk I'm willing to take. That's actually pretty good compared to some of the other ones I've said. All right, so that should be it. Don't think Monday's a holiday, or is it? When's Labor Day? That is coming up. Anyway, if Monday's not a holiday, I will see you then. If it is, I will see you in a couple of weeks. I'll now go and find out when Labor Day is. Have a brilliant week, everyone, and we will see you next time.